Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
We lost our humanity. We lost our dignity. We got punished for something we did not do.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells the story of the Black 14.
Our young lives were flipped upside down.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Monday, the 26th of February, these are our main stories. Tens of thousands of Brazilians rally in support of the former president, Jair Bolsonaro, as he's investigated over an alleged coup attempt. Israel's prime minister says there will be an offensive in the Gazan city of Rafah, even if a deal is reached to free hostages. In a rare admission, President Zelensky reveals more than 30,000 Ukrainian soldiers have been killed since Russia's full-scale invasion 2 years ago. Also in this podcast, Nikki Haley vows to fight on despite Donald Trump's latest Republican primary win, but he says he's now focusing on his opponent in the White House.
We're going to be up here on November 5th, and we're going to look at Joe Biden, and we're going to say, Joe, you're fired. Get out. Get out, Joe. You're fired.
And Bangladesh gives more protection to its rapidly dwindling population of wild elephants. We begin this podcast in Brazil, where tens of thousands of supporters of the former president, Jair Bolsonaro, have attended a rally in Sao Paulo to protest against the ongoing investigation he's facing over an alleged coup attempt. Many were wearing the green and yellow colours of the Brazilian flag. Mr. Bolsonaro has had his passport seized by police as they investigate whether he plotted a coup to stay in power after losing elections in 2022 to the left-wing president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. Addressing supporters at the rally, he called for an amnesty for dozens of people convicted of attacking government buildings in Brasilia in January 2023, shortly after Mr. Lula's government took office.
Their sentences went far beyond what's reasonable. I can't understand what led a small group of judges to give such harsh sentences to these poor people who were there on January the 8th.
Our South America correspondent, Ione Wells, was at the rally where organisers had predicted a turnout of 500,000. I asked her if their expectations had been met.
We don't yet have the sort of official numbers, but certainly the crowds that we saw were massive today. The whole of the kind of centre of Sao Paulo was absolutely rammed with his supporters. Very distinctive, as you say, because he instructed them all to wear the colours of Brazil. So there was crowds of green and yellow kind of flocking to that central avenue in Sao Paulo. Many also brandishing flags with his face on it, or kind of slogans in support of him. Although what was interesting was the tone of this rally was certainly a little more tame than some of them have been in the past. And I think that was partly because he had instructed a lot of his supporters not to kind of incite further action, for example, against some of the Brazilian authorities because of that ongoing investigation into him at the moment.
And the fact there was such a high turnout does show how divided Brazil is today.
That's right. Even though he is no longer president, even though he is barred from running for office again for another 8 years at least, he still is very much seen as the figurehead for the right in Brazil. His policies, his whether they be kind of his quite sort of strong religious views around family, or whether it be his kind of views on so-called cancel culture, or whether it be his anti-net zero kind of skepticism of climate change, all of those policies do still have a big following, clearly, as was demonstrated today. But as you say, Brazil still does feel like a very polarized country, because just a couple of weeks ago, when it was the anniversary of those riots that took place in Brasilia in January last year in support of President Bolsonaro, to mark that anniversary, there was a counter-protest here in Sao Paulo by supporters of the current left-wing president, Lula. So there are certainly kind of movements on both sides, fiercely divided about what they believe in and who should be running the country right now.
Ione Wells in Brazil. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says his country's planned offensive in Gaza's southernmost city, Rafah, where more than a million displaced Palestinians are sheltering, would put Israel within weeks of victory in its war against Hamas. In an interview with the American broadcaster CBS, Mr. Netanyahu said even if a ceasefire deal was agreed, which allowed the release of hostages, that would not stop Israel going after Hamas fighters in Rafah. It would just delay the offensive.
But understand, too, that I've asked the army to submit to me a double plan. First, to evacuate, to enable the evacuation of the Palestinian civilians in Gaza. And obviously, second, to destroy the remaining Hamas battalions. That gets us a real, real distance towards the completion of our victory. If we have a deal, it'll be delayed somewhat, but it'll happen. If we don't have a deal, we'll do it anyway. It has to be done because total victory is our goal and total victory is within reach.
Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Paul Adams, assessed the significance of the Israeli Prime Minister's words.
It is something that he and some of his ministers have said before. They have said, and they want Hamas to believe, that they are determined to finish the military job in the Gaza Strip. And that means launching an assault on the city of Rafah at some point where they believe that a number of Hamas battalions are still operating. Now, at the moment, there is absolutely no sign of the Israeli military preparing the ground for an assault. We have not seen any of the things that we saw in Gaza City or Khan Yunis, the mass leafleting of a city, the messaging to telling people to leave, and perhaps equally importantly, telling them where they should leave to. None of this has happened, which tells me that there is very little prospect of an assault on Rafah anytime soon. And in the meantime, a growing, although perhaps still slender, prospect of some kind of ceasefire deal.
And the thinking was that if there was this ceasefire deal, that would allow enough space and time for some kind of permanent end to the fighting to be brought about. But Mr. Netanyahu seemingly is contradicting that.
Well, it's a question of how much he thinks he can achieve militarily. Clearly, his sense of where we go next isn't necessarily the same as the Americans. I think if a ceasefire can be brought about before the start of Ramadan in exactly 2 weeks' time, then we are going to see some really, really intensive diplomacy to try and turn that temporary ceasefire, which could last a number of weeks, into something more permanent. And you have to ask the question, if a ceasefire can hold for as many as 6 weeks, and we see the steady return of the remaining Israeli hostages, will there really be an appetite to go back to war when that is over? Certainly the Israeli government wants everyone to believe that that appetite is undimmed. But it is that's quite a long way away, and a lot of diplomacy is going to happen between now and then.
And another key sticking point is the fact that there are 1 million displaced people in Rafah on top of the population that normally lives there. And all along, the international community has been asking, what will happen to these people? This is southernmost city in Gaza. Did Mr. Netanyahu have an answer to that?
No, he still talks in rather vague terms about where people will go. I mean, I think the Israeli government knows perfectly well that it cannot assault Rafah, which, as you say, is teeming with people, many of whom have left and had to flee places multiple times and who are really at their wits' end. To attack a city full of people like that would be an absolute catastrophe. The Israeli military knows it. The Israeli government knows it. So they have to go somewhere. And that is still an unanswered question. Some have been leaving. Some have been heading towards the coast to the area called Al-Mawasi. Others have gone up a little bit further north to Deir al-Bala. But frankly, there is not enough room to accommodate everybody. And that is one of the reasons why I think an assault on Rafah still feels like a rather distant prospect.
Paul Adams in Jerusalem. In a rare admission, President Zelensky says 31,000 Ukrainian soldiers have been killed since Russia's full-scale invasion 2 years ago. At a news conference in Kyiv to mark this solemn anniversary, Mr. Zelensky said he would not give the number of wounded troops, as this information would help Russia's military planners. After a year of setbacks for Ukraine, the defense minister said delays in sending Western aid were partly to blame for the casualties. Our Ukraine correspondent, James Waterhouse, was at the news conference.
President Zelensky's government held an eight-hour press conference in which almost every minister spoke. 2 years on from the start of the conflict, Mr. Zelensky said 31,000 Ukrainian soldiers had been killed, as had an estimated 180,000 Russians. Both figures are likely to be much higher. Ministers said half the military aid promised by Western allies was not being delivered on time, which was causing loss of life and territory. I asked Mr. Zelensky how he felt about that.
I am frustrated. Loss of time is loss of people. This is my biggest frustration. Long war means more victims. Victims can be different. Military, civilian and children. And the longer the Russians are on the occupied territories, the more of our children they deport to Russia. And the longer the war lasts, the more countries start to hesitate.
Ukraine's leader said that if his forces were well armed by Western allies, they would win this war with Russia, adding he was confident America would agree an aid package to support Ukraine, despite current measures being stalled in Congress. Commenting on last year's counteroffensive, the president said the Kremlin had known about the operation before it began, but gave no details.
James Waterhouse in Ukraine. In the battle for the Republican Party's nomination for the US presidential election, she's compared herself to David taking on Goliath. And Nikki Haley, despite suffering another defeat at the hands of Donald Trump, this time in her home state of South Carolina, is still refusing to give up, pointing to the fact that she got around 40% of the vote to Mr. Trump's 60. From South Carolina, Will Vernon sent this report.
The great state of South Carolina.
Another victory. Another landslide. Donald Trump's march to the nomination feels unstoppable.
Wow!
Speaking at a rally, Mr. Trump didn't even mention his Republican rival. His sights appear to be firmly set on the presidential election in November.
And we're going to be up here on November 5th, and we're going to look at Joe Biden, and we're going to look him right in the eye. He's destroying our country, and we're going to say, Joe, you're fired. Get out. Get out, Joe. You're fired.
I'm standing outside the Trump victory rally at the South Carolina State Fair in Columbia. This is yet another resounding win for Donald Trump, who is steamrolling towards victory in this primary contest. Here in South Carolina, Mr. Trump was looking to bolster his position as the undisputed, unassailable frontrunner in this race. And that's exactly what he's done.
He's going to save us from this mess that Joe Biden has perpetrated upon my country.
Mr. Trump's supporters say this race is effectively over.
He's going to steal the border. He's going to start drilling the pipeline, open up the pipelines. He's going to give us our country back. He can run the government from inside the White House on house arrest. We don't care. We don't care. We're voting for him.
Oh, thank you, thank you, thank you. Y'all are a rowdy bunch.
Despite trailing Trump by a wide margin, Nikki Haley was defiant, vowing to continue her campaign.
I said earlier this week that no matter what happens in South Carolina, I would continue to run for president. I'm a woman of my word.
And I felt like the Lord impressed upon my heart that she was definitely going to be president someday.
Shoe shop owner Zoe Owen and her husband Sean from Columbia are backing Nikki Haley. Sean recently switched his support from Mr. Trump to the former governor.
But then after New Hampshire, and he saw how her friend treated her, he was like, okay, I'm off the Trump train.
I think it's time for a new leadership. I think it's time for a younger generation. She's not a demagogue. I think what's going to be interesting is the underdog story. America always likes a great underdog. I think she's got that chutzpah to really take on that fight.
Why do you think it is that Donald Trump's so popular in, well, here in South Carolina, nationally as well?
So Donald Trump is a celebrity, right? And I think he's become an idol that America's ready to tear down. In America, we don't have kings. We don't have people that we bow down to. The only person that we bow down to is the one true and living God. Donald Trump is not a god, and Donald Trump is not a king.
King Trump he is not, but the former president's lead in the polls, nevertheless, is sizable.
Our slogan is Smiling Faces, Beautiful Places.
David Wilson is a political consultant based in South Carolina.
The flow is going in Donald Trump's direction. I think he has such a groundswell of support. It's kind of like the black hole that's pulling everybody in.
Mr. Wilson says Haley could remain in the race as an alternative if Mr. Trump's legal problems lead to any nasty surprises in the nomination.
I think Nikki Haley is kind of like the player who's on the sideline standing right next to the coach, hoping that somebody gets injured and gets called and pulled out of the game, standing there going, I'm ready to go in, coach. I'm ready to go in. Can I go in now?
But Haley supporters Zoe and Sean Owen say their woman is in it to win it.
I think if there's going to be a woman president, which there will be one day, you need someone who has the tenacity of a Margaret Thatcher.
South Carolina's answer to Margaret Thatcher.
Yes!
That's right.
Yay!
That report by Will Vernon. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
In every direction I look, I am surrounded by men wearing next to nothing. Think sumo-style groin cloths in freezing conditions.
The ancient Japanese ritual that's finally becoming more inclusive.
When you see Iran close up, you realize just how complex a political landscape it is.
The Global Story. Smart takes and fresh perspectives on one big news story.
It seems that Iran's strategy at the moment is to increase the tension in the Middle East.
Every Monday to Friday from the BBC World Service.
When Israel does agree to a ceasefire in Gaza, Iran will then worry about Israel then turning its sights towards Iran again.
The Global Story. Find it wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. Bangladesh has taken steps to stop the exploitation of critically endangered wild elephants by ruling against their capture and subsequent mistreatment. The High Court has suspended the granting of licenses to allow elephants to be reared in captivity. Animal rights groups have welcomed the move. They say domesticated elephants in Bangladesh are routinely tortured and even killed. Rachel Wright reports.
Bangladesh was once one of the major homes for Asian elephants, but numbers have been decreasing for decades. As humans encroach on their natural habitat, elephants have been forced out of the forest in search of food. And when they do, it usually doesn't end well for the elephant. Farmers erect electric fences around their precious crops, which can injure and even kill the hungry elephant. This has led to the rapid decline in the population of the Bangladesh elephant. With only 200 left, they've been declared critically endangered. And half of that number are in captivity. It's been the tradition for centuries for elephants to be captured for domestic use, mainly to carry logs or to work in the circus for which the Forest Department has issued licences. But Bangladesh's Deputy Attorney General said that the terms of the licences were being broken and unscrupulous owners were using the animals to beg by daubing them with paint and using them to block passers-by to extort money. And in circuses, elephant calves were being brutally separated from their mothers, shackled for months, and then tortured into learning tricks. Recently, pictures of a captive elephant hit by a train have helped animal rights groups in their campaign. And after a prominent actress launched a public interest litigation against captive elephant licensing, the High Court today suspended all licenses for the capture of elephants from the wild. Animal rights groups say they will now try to mobilise support for the rehabilitation of all the captive elephants, as has been done in Nepal and Thailand. Meanwhile, Bangladesh's Forest Department are working on a project to maintain the natural habitats for the elephants to protect those in the wild from extinction.
Rachel Wright. Leaking a politician or journalist's phone number in any country would be considered by some to be dangerous. But in Mexico, with its high levels of drug-related violence, it's even more alarming. The frontrunner in the presidential election, due to be held in June, says that she's been deluged by hate-filled messages. And a son of the current president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, says his number has also been leaked. The frontrunner for the presidential election, Claudia Sheinbaum, is a close ally of Mr. López Obrador. He's blamed political opponents. He himself has caused an uproar by recently disclosing the number of a journalist who was investigating the drug cartels. I got more on the story with our America's regional editor, Leonardo Rocha.
All that's happening in Mexico is in the context of presidential elections in June. You have two women are running for office, and let's say the governing candidate, the main candidate is expected to win. And you have President López Obrador, who I think would have liked to run for office, but the Constitution doesn't allow re-election. And the New York Times, a couple of weeks ago, published a report saying that in his first attempt to become president, he lost. He received money from the drug cartels, which is a very serious accusation. The president didn't like that, but that was put to rest. And then more recently, just a week ago, we had the New York Times again published a report saying that for years, the U.S. investigated Mr. López Obrador to check if he had received millions of dollars from the cartels in his current government since taking office in 2018. That's much more serious. And the conclusion of the report was that they couldn't find any evidence. Basically, he was innocent. The president got furious. And then during a press conference, he does a media conference every day. So during this media conference, he showed on the screen a request for an interview by the New York Times bureau chief in Mexico, and there on the screen you could see the name and the details, the phone number, email of this journalist. And that caused huge, basically, outrage in Mexico and in the United States. He was accused of exposing and putting that journalist in danger, basically.
And now we've got the front runner in the presidential election, a candidate who's from Mr. López Obrador's party, saying that she's receiving all these messages of hate because her phone number's been leaked. And his son is also talking about his number being leaked, saying that poses a danger to his family.
Yes. So what happened since then is those who are opposed to the president have then gone online and published the details of the presidential candidate and also his son. And again, President López Obrador was furious about that. Now, the opposition candidate has also said that her name has been exposed. But I think we have to understand that in the context of Mexico. Mexico is the most dangerous country for journalists outside any war zone in the world. More than 100 have been killed in the past decade. And by exposing the names, giving that details online, you're putting their lives really at risk, because the drug cartels, they will target, they will kill anyone who reports on corruption and on crime.
Leonardo Rocha. He was once China's richest man. Now the death has been announced of Zhang Qingko at the age of 79. He founded a beverage company in the 1980s, rising from poverty to amass a multi-billion dollar fortune. 12 years ago, he spoke to the BBC about his status as one of China's wealthiest men.
Lots of people here are still poor, while only a small number are rich. This wealth gap has become a huge problem and has triggered social dissatisfaction. I spend less than my workers. I believe in a simple life. I give money to charity. So even though I'm rich, I wouldn't be hated for it. The rich should earn respect.
Our Asia-Pacific editor, Mickey Bristow, reflects on Zhang Qingko's unlikely success.
It's the ultimate rags-to-riches story. He was born in 1945 to a very, very poor family. And when the communist regime got going in the 50s and 60s, he was sent actually down to the countryside with millions of others to work with the peasants and farmers. So a terrible start in many respects to his life. He came back to Hangzhou, a city, worked as a salesman, and didn't get his start in business until he was well into his 40s, quite late in life. He started off working at a school, selling ice lollies and drinks to students there. He expanded that business, and before very long, he ended up being a billionaire a massive drinks empire. And so it really is a meteoric rise, but also it's a rise which happened quite a lot in China. If you remember at the time in the 1980s, China was opening up, politics, economics was changing, the Communist Party were accepting capitalists, foreign investment. And so it really offered an opportunity for people like Mr. Zhong. You had 1.3 billion customers who had not enough services, not enough goods. And so people who came across like him, started up businesses, often made a killing just as he did.
Mickey Bristow. Finally, to an ancient Japanese ritual that dates back more than 1,000 years, the Hadaka Matsuri, or the Naked Festival as it's sometimes known. Thousands of barely clothed men huddle together and attempt to drive away evil spirits. But this year, there's been a big change. For the first time ever, women have been allowed to take part. Shaima Khalil was there to witness history in the making.
It's freezing here in Inazawa, in central Japan. I'm standing outside the Konomiya Shinto Shrine. And the fact that it's really cold matters because in every direction I look, I am surrounded by men wearing next to nothing. Think sumo-style groin cloths in freezing conditions. I honestly don't know how they're doing it. I'm told they've been provided with a good deal of sake. And every now and then they get showered with very cold water, just to make things interesting. The men are jumping, they're chanting, they're huddling, they're clashing. Some are climbing over one another to get to the chosen man. And this man is chosen by the shrine. All of this so they can touch him and attract good luck and drive away evil spirits. Washoi, washoi. It's the chant. And I think it's more of them encouraging each other to keep moving because it's really cold. It almost means like, let's go, let's go. For centuries, this ceremony has been off limits to women until this year. And I won't leave it to your imagination for long and tell you quickly, the women are fully clothed and not part of the men's huddle. They're making their own offerings in their own dedicated ceremony. Still, this is a historic day.
My husband has always taken part in the festival, and I was always a spectator. I never ever thought I could participate.
Atsuko Tamako, she is a 56-year-old grandmother whose family has been involved in this festival for generations. She tells me that her husband and other men in the community are supportive, but it hasn't been easy.
There were voices who were concerned about it, saying, what are women doing in a men's festival? But we were all united in what we wanted to do. We believed that God would watch over us if we were sincere.
This is the moment. They're making their way to the Shinto shrine to make their offerings. This is something no woman in Japan has ever done before. For the first time, more than 1,000 years, women are now taking part in one of Japan's most famous naked festivals.
Standing in front of the Konomiya shrine in purple robes, headbands, and white shorts, the women make their offering and end the ceremony in the traditional bows and claps. Then, the enormity of the moment sets in. They hug each other and cry.
It's totally exciting. Thank you so much. It was good. It was really good. I'm so happy that I could participate for the first time as a woman. Becoming the first person to do this is so great.
These women didn't just break gender barriers, they're also keeping the tradition alive. Japan's aging population is a big threat to these festivals. This week, another naked festival, held at the Kokuseki Temple in northern Japan, said this would be the last one they would hold. There's simply not enough young people to keep it going. Japan started this year with an earthquake and a huge fire on the tarmac of Haneda Airport. It has now also fallen into unexpected recession. So this good fortune ceremony could not be more timely, and the country will need all the help it can get from both men and women.
That report by Shaima Khalil. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll. The producer was Chantal Hartle. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Jeanette Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.